you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and for the 1670th time, we're beginning the TechNet on LIMOC, which we've been doing for the last 1982 to now is 35 years, I think it is. Yeah, 35 years as of the end of the last month. The main purpose of the TechNet, meeting each Sunday night for quite a few hours, starting at 8 o'clock, is to gather the radio amateurs and other electronic enthusiasts who are curious about radio in general. A curious person wants to know more about how does it work, how to make it work better, how to understand it all. Can you drop? By way of my experience at the Airborne Instruments Laboratory for 35 years and another 10 and a fraction years of consulting beyond that, I've been exposed to radio circuits for 45 years as a professional and 5 or 10 years before that. So I've been living with radio and wireless products for a long time. Now when it comes to the things that I've learned over that time, I've seen lots of hardware on the B-1B bomber program that I've worked on for 20 years at the EA-6D Navy standoff jammer. The bomber, by the way, is an Air Force aircraft. So a lot of exposure to military electronics. And by way of that learning, I can, and it's not so complicated, by the way, I can calculate how strong the signal is going to be from the Voyager spacecraft, which is 12 or 13 billion miles away, three times the distance of Pluto. I can calculate how strong the signal is going to be. That's not a big deal. So when it comes to manipulating radio and antennas and transmission lines, I've got a fair amount of experience at doing that. You would think, therefore, I understand it. I am still kind of amazed. How in the world did that signal get from the Apollo astronauts on the moon down to my homemade coal-foot diameter dish antenna in Farmingdale back in 1971 on Apollo 15 and Apollo 16? What really went through that vacuum of space, a quarter million miles, the so-called radio signal? What really was that? We can calculate it. We give it all kinds of names. So what is it? It's still kind of a mystery to me. And maybe it is to you also. Let me drop. If a person does have a question or a comment for the net on any of the subjects we usually discuss, any subject of interest to ham radio operators, other than blondes and brunettes, you're going to give me your call letters and your name. A typical sign-in would sound like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. He's the guy, by the way, who runs our space report. And Paul will be giving a space report number 270 tonight. So, if you've got a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name right now. T2RIW listening.
N2HUH, Sandy Andean, Queens, New York.
Okay. We've got Andy. Who else?
DXK, Free, and yes.
Okay, I think that was Craig, CXK. I missed the beginning, Craig, is it? WB2?
Negative. Kilo Delta 2, Charlie X-ray Kilo. And yes, I have a question for the net.
Kilo Delta 2, Charlie X-ray Kilo. Okay, we got you, Craig. So we got Andy and Craig. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
VBN, question.
Okay, that person was very quick on the switch. I heard BBN. I'm going to guess it's a Freddy. KB2B is BBN, I'm going to guess. Am I correct, Freddy? I'm not quite sure where you were standing. Maybe you're using a handy talkie, Freddy. That was mostly dropout. And we'll be getting to you within about a half hour, so I hope you're going to be there. So we got Andy, Craig, and Freddie. Anyone else? Give me a call letter and a name right now.
And WS2N. Good evening, Dick. You're right. 270. Name is Paul.
Okay. There was some dropouts there, Paul, which is machine is giving lots of people lots of dropouts tonight. So something well, there's band openings going on. I can tell. I'm hearing the equivalent of a TechNet in Pennsylvania, on the 146.85 frequency when this repeater is not there. One last call. Anyone else to check in with the TechNet tonight? Because you do have a question or a comment. Give me a call letter and a name right now. You're number one on the runway, Andy. NQHUH, P2LIW. Go right ahead, Andy.
All radio, Dick. Thank you. I have a modern solid-state radio that I still haven't had a chance to troubleshoot yet or even look at the schematic because I've been so busy with other things. But what I like to throw out there for speculation or actually troubleshoot is the radio, the HF radio on HF is only putting out half its output that it was the week before. One half output. Now, we might say, that's the worst case scenario. Instead of putting out 100 watts, it's only putting out 40 or 50 watts. It has a pair of PAs. It has a driver, and I believe it also has pre-drivers. But until I look at the schematic, I can't be 100% sure. So any speculation on what that could be without the troubleshooting first, N2HUH.
Okay, I'm going to ask you for a little bit more background information, Andy. What was your method of measuring power output? Was it that dial in the front panel of the transmitter? Was it a bird watt meter or something like that? So some external device that was measuring the power output, question number one. Question number two, do you have any reason to believe there was any change in the standing wave ratio of your antenna? If an antenna suddenly develops a whole lot of SWR, somebody will put out less power under that condition to go into a partial fallback, final stage protection mode of operation and so on. So any change in the visual? How did you measure power output? And is it true on more than one band? Is it only on the 80 meter band you see this, or do you see this on all bands? So answer some of those questions, Andy. N2HUH, K2LIW in the TechNet.
All right, Dick. Well, let's see here. It's not the antenna or the cables or anything like that. That's sort of what I went through when I did have time. I have other rigs, and they're all fine on antennas. And I use a dummy load. I use two different watt meters, plus the internal watt meter in the radio. So all three concur. 40 to 50 watts output on all bands, 160 meters to 10 meters.
Okay, that's good information. So by way of dummy loads and two different watt meters, you're confirming the real power output. And assuming you're giving the rig 13.8 volts by way of a good power supply, and that's something also to worry about. If your power supply is going down to 11 volts, that could aggravate it. Also, many rigs nowadays, or at least in the old days, used to have a driver control. So as you adjust that driver control, you can make the power output change. And as you crank up that driver control, under normal circumstances, maybe you only had to crank it to 75 or 80% in order to get the full 100 watts of output. When you do it now, when you're cranking that driver control, do you see the power output maximize at 40 or 50 watts when you're at the 75% point on that driver control? And then when you turn the driver control, nothing further happens. Would be another strong clue. So if you do have a driver control and you can change it, you see any change in the way it used to work and the way it works now? Back to you, Andy. K2LIW.
Well, some radios have a separate RF and a separate drive. This one doesn't. It's just RF power output on FM. It's 50 watts. And pretty much that's it. Between 40 and 50 watts on FM. And all other modes are the same, or less power output.
Yeah, the best way to get a steady carrier output is the FM mode. But when you're in the single sideband mode, and either running Morse code, or with key down, and maybe there's a driver control, or when you're whistling into the mic, in the sideband mode, most rigs will have a driver control. So in the sideband mode, or one of those linear modes, do you have a driver control, and will you operate it Is it operating differently than it used to? WNHRIW.
Say, I think I looked for that and it seems to go work rather linearly up to the 40 or 50 watt power output, and then it's let's say it's at the halfway point and then it just won't go any further. Maximum it'll put out is about 40 to 50 watts, and that's the control halfway up. That's pretty much the symptoms. If you have any other questions, fire away.
Yeah, that's another good piece of information. So now you do have strong evidence by maximum power output, 50% on the drive control and the sideband mode, and you go beyond the 50% point, no further power output is occurring. So you are certainly getting saturation. It looks like saturation beyond that driver control. And we're assuming you're putting the full 14.8 volts into it, you have reason to believe that hasn't dropped down. First of all, what is your method of confirming the fact that the rig is getting the normal DC input voltage of, say, 13.8 volts? Has that been confirmed, Andy? Go ahead.
Confirmed with the voltmeter, wattmeter, and more than one radio connected to the power supply. Don't run more than one radio. Astron power supply, linear supply, you know, the usual 40-pound transformer, whatever, 30-pound transformer. And other radios operate 100% perfect. That's the said radio in question.
Okay, the radio in question, please tell us the model number and the brand name, and is it a tube rig or a solid-state rig? Back to you, Andy.
It's solid state. It's a solid state rig from, I guess, 2000, or just like before 2000 ever. It's my Yaesu FT-847 satellite radio. And I actually like it for satellite better than the TS-2000, which I don't have any problem with mine for 3 years now. I use it for HF with amplifier. I use it with VHF for UHF, VHF. I'm using it now, and I've never had a problem with it. And so that's the FT-847. And I hope you had another question in hand.
You've answered all of our questions very well so far, Andy. Now, was this a sudden change? In other words, on Monday you had 100 watts of output, and on Tuesday it was only 50 watts. Or over some period of time, did you see a slow fade of power output? So what was the history for you to detect the low power output, Andy? Go ahead.
I used it basically in the same antenna and tuning system that I use all the time on a daily basis with other solid-state radios with no problem. I decided to just see how the audio was on whatever band I was using on. I don't remember the specific band. And it was working fine. This was, let's say, on a Monday, and the following Monday or Tuesday, for some strange reason, I wanted to use it again. And, of course, then I said, what the heck happened here? This radio was working perfectly. Good signal reports, everything. The last time I transmit on it was working full output, to my knowledge, and I was having it do so. Now, a week later, 40, 50 watts output, huh? What happened? And that's why I'm asking.
Now that it's putting out 40 or 50 watts on all bands, 8 to 10 meters, when you use it in a sideband mode and talk to somebody, do they complain about any kind of audio distortion on your sideband? Or have you used it in the FM mode, still putting out 40 or 50 watts? My guess is you can't tell the difference. And people probably say, you're a little bit noisier, but and in the repeater, but you sound the same. But have you had a chance to talk to anybody on the sideband mode to find out if they're complaining of flat top distortion, so to speak? Andy, go ahead.
Well, now it's almost a QRP rig on single sideband, because I think I'd have to whistle into the mic to get the 40 or 50 watts output. Now I'd have to scream into the whistle to get that. So I think it's only putting out 10 to 20 watts on sideband, 50 watts on FM. But I could have sworn I heard a little crackling noises in my audio when I was monitoring the audio out of that. That's what I was listening to, sideband, FM, possibly AM also. I was listening to my audio. Then I heard a little, but then that disappeared, so I don't know what that may have been that I thought I was listening to. Could have been something not related at all to the rig. Because it's doing the same thing, and yet I hear, right now I hear nothing, no sound, no extraneous noises on my audio. The audio sounds smooth and clean and clear. It's just reduced output, reduced wattage. I was hoping to troubleshoot it with the symptoms. That's my goal, is without actually going in and doing it.
Understand. When it comes to using a rig in the FM mode, talking through a repeater, listening to yourself coming out of the repeater or listening to your output frequency, in the FM mode, you can monitor yourself. Because the way a limiter in the receiver works, even though it's, the rig is in the same shack with you and it's giving you an extremely strong signal, the overload doesn't hurt. In the sideband mode, you try to listen to yourself, you're going to hear all kinds of strange things. So, and that's when you heard the crackling noise, or even if you heard the crackling noise acoustically coming out of the rig itself, that would be a clue. So, it does sound like something near the final stage has had a failure. Maybe your final stage has got, internally there's two separate transistors in one package or two separate packages. So it does sound like final stage troubleshooting might be required, which is not easy. Not easy at all. Depending on how well equipped you are, let me drop this. A person who had a real good shop and very well equipped would use maybe sniffing techniques with something on the end of a loop of wire, a semiconductor of a transmission line, a coax cable, on the end of a coax cable going into a spectrum analyzer, and he'd be measuring the magnitude of the drive going into the final stage, confirm that that's normal, or maybe with an RF voltmeter, he'd confirm that. So, to confirm failure of a final stage, by the way, the current that it draws, it sure would be nice if your regulated power supply had a voltmeter and a current meter on it. And you could also determine that the amount of current the rig is drawing is less than normal. That would be a strong clue. But again, a final stage either is underdriven, but more likely, I think, a final stage has had a failure. But that's a pure guess. So troubleshooting a final stage failure without doing complete substitution, which is not easy, to unsoldder of the old transistor and plug a new one in there to confirm that that's it, is not easy. I wonder if you have any. I'm hearing some hiss in the background. Stand by. I use my radio mallet, the fist of my right hand, to tap on my rig. So tell me what equipment you've got where if you open the case, and if you do open the case and start doing troubleshooting, and if you've got a schematic diagram of the rig, hopefully the owner's manual gave you a schematic, or maybe you own a service manual, before you go too far, make sure you measure every one of the voltages of the power supply. I remember the Kenwood TS-7000, 700, 7000, whichever it was, a 2-meter all-mode
repeater, timeout.
A 2-meter all-mode rig that a friend of mine was having trouble with. It was low in power output, low in receiver gain, low in S-meter deflection. Everything was low. And I was going crazy looking for the bad stage. And it turns out that the 6-volt reference power supply, that's the reference for all the other regulators in the rig, that was down to something like 4 volts. The Zener diode, the 6-volt Zener diode had failed, partially failed. And I had spent a week doing troubleshooting. It seemed like every stage was low. Well, every stage was low because all the power supply voltages were low. So the very first thing you do, if you do open up the case, before you dig too deeply, measure every single supply voltage. So from your point of view, Andy, how well equipped do you think you are for troubleshooting the final stage? And if the answer is you don't have a lot of test equipment and feel a little bit uncomfortable doing that, then it may be time to visit Andy's at A2CEL. N2HUH, K2RIW, for any of the above information. You got it, Andy. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. To answer one of your previous questions, that was during that transmission. It's about, it usually draws 18 to 20 amps on HF full output, and I think it's about 12 amps now, approximately 12 amps. And I do want to say I do repair and maintain my own radios. I've repaired a lot of different problems with different vintage radios. I have one radio for every for every decade, I think. I have from 1960 to almost current. Every 10 years, another model radio. And if I can't fix it, then it don't get fixed. I don't bring my radios anywhere to be repaired, and I wouldn't send them to be repaired. So if I can't fix it, I don't want it. Let me let it drop and tell you about my test equipment. I don't want to be too overconfident. I think I have enough test equipment to do almost any repair, either directly or in a roundabout way. And on the roundabout way, I have to discover. I know it takes me a long time to do any repair I do. That's why I like this one was a new challenge. And I do want to say that I only repair a radio when I'm actually in the right frame of mind and I have a lot of time, and my bench is cleaned off, which right now it isn't, so that's why I wanted to get an early start mentally on the troubleshooting. And let me make one other comment. I actually had the radio apart, and I have to take off a layer of circuit boards to get to the final section, which is hidden underneath a... And I actually had it open, and I go in there, and I'm hoping to find something burnt or something obvious or something that was really obvious. Or then I started soldering to check some of the devices, and everything was checking fine. I said, well, unless that was actually one of my questions from the previous net was, can a component actually start becoming defective, but still test what it like, say an ohm meter, to be good. Most finals I can test and with an ohm meter in it. Oh, this is bad. Open shorted. But it reduced capacity. That's why it didn't make any sense to me how the driver and the PAs tested good. But then I realized later on that I think there's a pre-driver also that I didn't check. But the radio was all buttoned up. But it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and I had enough, and I buttoned it all up, and I said, well, I'm not working on this until I get more time into H2H.
Yeah, what you're looking for now is something that's built just before the final stage, so the final stage is not getting full drive, and confirming that without an RF voltmeter is going to be a little bit difficult. I'm looking at the FT847. When you Google those words, they show you pictures of the rig, good-looking rig. Confirming that the drive is proper is doable, not easy. Everything is hanging together where you've got less than normal current output, less than normal power output. That final stage just doesn't have as much hair in its chest as it used to have, is one possibility, or it's not being driven hard enough. Let me pass it over to the net of these guys out there that have also done troubleshooting. Andy's Yaesu FT847 puts out only 40 or 50 watts on every one of the HF bands in any of the modes. And by the way, the fact that you only see 10 watts in the sideband mode, that's kind of normal. Because the power output meter, if it's not a peak detecting meter, let me drop it. Unless your power sensing meter is not a peak detecting type, confirming that your peak envelope power in the sideband mode is not easy. You could be putting out 100 watts peak envelope power without a whole lot of speech clipping, and you're talking normally into the microphone, and you may only see 40 watts on the power meter, because that's what the average is. Well, the peaks are there, but they're only there, and the 100 watt peaks are there, but they're only there briefly, if you know what I mean. Whereas in the FM mode, of course, you'll see the 100 watts. So the fact that you see lower than 40 watts in the sideband mode in your power meter could be a normal indication that you're still putting out 40 watts of peak envelope power. Let's see. Do you have anyone out there now with any further suggestions for what Andy should do next after he's checked all the power supplies of all the internal voltage regulators once he takes the cover off? He's probably already done that. And so the 40 watts output instead of the 100 watts. Anybody have any further suggestions? Give me a call. Let us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. We're listening. Yeah, I'm a little disappointed, Andy, that the normal troubleshooting people are not coming in with some... Okay.
I'm listening to W8CDL Mobile.
Hey, we got both of them. Eric first and Andy second. KE2EJ, go right ahead, Andy. I mean, Eric, what would you do next, Eric? Go out and buy another rig. Eric, you got it.
Yeah, I happen to have an 847. That's my main rig. I like it. I use it for satellite stuff. So what exactly is this problem?
In 80 to 10 meters, it puts out 40 to 50 watts instead of 100 watts in the FM mode. And in the sideband mode, he's got indication that the peak envelope power probably is almost the same. As he operates the drive control, normally in the sideband mode, he gets full power output at 50% drive. At 50% drive, it comes up to 40 watts of output, and as he turns the drive control further in the sideband mode, no further power output occurs. It's drawing two-thirds of normal current, 30 to 40 watts, 40 to 50 watts of power output instead of 100 on all bands. And he's opened up the case, given it a good visual inspection, doesn't see anything obvious. So what do you recommend he do next, Eric? And now I'm going to go over to Andy after Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ.
This
sounds like he's lost one of his power transistors or the pre-driver. The pre-driver is an MRF-5015, and the output transistors, if I remember correctly, are 2SC5125 or 26s. I think they're 25. Anyway, the output is kind of push-pull, so it sounds like he's missing one of them.
Comment? Before comment, Eric, what's the easiest way of confirming that one of them is missing, so to speak? Go ahead.
No, if you go into the service manual, if you happen to have it, if you don't download it, it'll tell you how much drive should be hitting the PA, and if you don't got that, then you got a problem earlier, but I kind of doubt that. Because it's real low level. The only way to do it is to go step by step and see how much RF you get it. There's actually two transistors before the final output, and you can do it by voltage and current measurement, but ideally is pull them out and put them on a curve chase is the best way to do it, but I don't think he's going to do that, so there is a possibility that one of the filters or the relays are bad. I've seen that happen. Actually, the SWR detection is after that stuff because that radio will do a whole bunch of things. So, good old signal tracing. If you got a RF voltmeter, that's the best way. K2RWK2J.
Okay, thank you for the preliminary information. Who is the person that said comment? Because we've also got Andy, the B2CDL, waiting in the wings. Comment person, please give us your call letters and name.
That was me, Dick, with the comment, Andy. Andy. And hello, Eric and Andy. Don't want that to get confusing. No, when I had the radio open at 4 o'clock in the morning, I confirmed that the PAs are not shorted or open, and I confirmed that the drivers aren't shorted or open. That was that's what I did at 4 in the morning, and then I got disgusted when I couldn't find anything wrong and buttoned it all back up. And but I think when I glanced at it at 4 or 5 or 6 in the morning, the schematic, I could have sworn I saw pre-drivers in the HS section, which I'm not used to. So is there, maybe you can confirm for me, Eric, is it
PAs, drivers, and pre-drivers, or just what I'm accustomed to? I like calling it the PAs and then the drivers. I thought I saw an extra pair of pre-drivers, but I could be wrong.
You've got it, Eric. Wait for the beep.
Now, Andy, if you remember looking at it, there's a phono connector that comes up to the PA board. That goes into a MOSFET, goes into an MRF, 5745. That takes it from, either 0 dBm or 10 dBm at that point, and I think that first transistor's got like 6 dB gain. And then that goes into another MOSFET, which is a little bit, it has a little more gain, which is the actual driver for the power transistor. There is a bias transistor at the top. By the way, you should measure the bias current, that also will give you a good indication. Both pre-drivers have an adjustable bias control, just as much as the output transistors have a bias control on them too, so. That, in turn, goes into a pair of two SC5125s. Just remember that those are actually multiple transistors in a case. The fact that you don't see them shorted, and you don't see them open, and doing an in-circuit test is not really a very good thing because of the way the DC is connected to that thing and the way it's associated to ground. So, actually, on a lot of transistors, it'll look like got a short, but in fact you don't. Because RF and DC are two different games, but ultimately the best way to find your problem is with a simple RF voltmeter or a voltmeter with a diode connected to it to a capacitor resistor to turn that RF into a DC voltage. You can actually figure out how much gain you're getting at each stage.
Got a question for you, Andy. Eric, stand by. There's a couple of bias transistors up top, you said. That probably means on the schematics are high. That are adjusting the bias voltages for the driver stages, the pre-driver stage, and maybe the final stage. And you wanted to know that they were giving the right current and or voltage. And you said it's adjustable. Adjustable probably means there's a potentiometer. And one of the most unreliable things in the world, electronically, is a potentiometer. Wouldn't it be nice if the potentiometer just decided to become an open circuit or a partial open circuit or it got scratchy and just by jiggling the control on the potentiometer it comes back to normal operation and by monitoring that bias voltage that might give you a strong clue. Bunch of guesses on my part. I wonder, Eric, if the this particular rig, the FT847, has any history of intermittency of its bias potentiometers, KE2EJ, KQLIW, and the TechNet?
The answer to that question, from my experience, is I don't know. I've never experienced that. But the props of those things are pretty good. Actually, the pre-drivers get their, they're not coming from a constant current source like the alpha transistors are. It's just coming right from the supply rail. There's actually, there's no regulator on it. Or is there? I'm looking at the schematic right now. Now, they come straight from the supply rail. The output stage has its own constant current source, so. If you go through the book, you'll find that behind each one of those parts is a measuring point where you can actually. You got to set it to measure to correct voltage to put on the gate of those two MOSFETs, and then I think there's a choke where you measure the bias current for the outputs. But that's another way. It's another clue. It's not the ultimate answer, though.
Okay, by looking at that schematic and knowing what voltage should exist on every one of those points on the bias transistors, pre-drivers, drivers, and so on, what standby voltage should be there before the drive is applied, or maybe after the drive is applied? That's a
no drive when you make that measurement.
Okay, so we'll all do this cold, with no drive. so making all those voltage measurements, that's a very non-destructive method to do troubleshooting, as long as you're careful enough not to create any short circuits with those probes. Andy, WA2CDL, what are your suggestions with reference to this FT-847? WA2, commercial driver's license, K2LIW, the text ad.
Okay, Dick, good evening. Hello to everyone. Just the basic questions, I was curious. One is, how much current is it drawing from the power supply with full power output, whatever power you're getting? How much current is it drawing? So that's question number one. And the other thing is what Eric mentioned is, what's the idling current? How much idling current is it drawing? And is it meeting the specification according to the service manual? So that would also, you know, be a clue. And it makes sense that there would be individual pots to put the transistors in the linear mode, the sideband. Also, this is a multi-band radio. I don't know. Do they use the same transistors, the same final and driver for UHF and VHF as well as HF? Because if they do, if it's the same transistors and the power is normal on UHF or VHF, then it's something else. You get what I'm saying? I don't know. Some rigs use the same transistor because they're very wide-banded, and they don't have to switch to a different set of finals and drivers for UHF, VHF. I'm not familiar with this radio, so I don't know if it does that. That was my other suggestion. Check that. See what's the power on the other bands. Not HF, though. Dick, back to you.
I will answer those
separate bit-to-meters and 440. The main amplifier does HF through 6 meters. That's it.
You've got it, Andy. And I'm pretty sure you gave us two-thirds of the normal current output when it's putting out 50 watts instead of 100.
Repeater, time out.
And the idling and standby current. Answer as many of those questions as you can for CDL. And 2HUH, you got it, Andy, number one.
Audio, HF is separate than the VHF UHF. Originally, with 100 watts output on HF, about 18 to 20 amps of draw. Steve, current is normal, as it always been. And right now, on reduced output of approximately 40 to 50 watts output, I'm drawing about 12 amps. Approximately 12 amps of current. WA2CDL and 2HUH.
Micro band transistor.
Can you just say something about that?
Yeah, those push-pull finals, where one of them maybe is not doing anything, that would fit that scenario that Eric was telling us about. Mr. CDL, go right ahead. I'll wait for the beeps.
Yeah, if it's drawing 12 amps to only get 50 watts out, that's a problem. It should draw a lot less current than that. So you might disconnect. First of all, check the bias to see if the biasing is right. And but if it's MOSFET, then it's not going to draw any current. It's a voltage adjustment. As far as the transistor is concerned. But it does sound like you're drawing way too much current for that little power output. Nick, do you agree with that?
By the way, the output transistors are bipolar, and they're three drivers, and the driver's MOSFET.
Yeah, one of Eric's speculations, Andy number two, one of Eric's speculations was that the push-pull final bipolar transistors, if one of them became dead, that could give you half power output at half the current drain of the final stage, and all the other stages are drawing a essentially normal current, we'll say. So that would allow you to take, let me call it 19 amps of normal full power output current drain on the 13 volts, 19 amps, and now he's down to 12 amps. One final push-pull transistor being dead would fit that scenario. I'm pretty sure. Let's see what Eric feels on that one. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, you know, he could probably own, if he pulled those transistors out and owned them, they probably would look like normal transistors. Don't forget, these transistors are made out of seven or eight different slices that are all on the same substrate. They're wired together in parallel, so that's why I'm a big fan of a RF voltmeter, and actually, in this case, I'd want to use an effective voltmeter, simply because you can tell which side is which. But yeah, it truly sounds like he's got a transistor with either low or no gain.
When Andy goes in there with his RF voltmeter, if he measures essentially the right RF voltage for drive, and then the push-pull stage is going to be an RF AC coupled stage, so to speak, he's going to see two-thirds the normal RF voltage. To pin down which transistor is active and which transistor is inactive, it'd be nice if there was a very small tenth of an ohm emitter to ground resistor on each of the push-pull finals.
Oh, you should be so lucky. The emitters on each change are grounded.
Okay. It sure would be nice, as I said, and you measure the voltage drop across that resistor. So the balancing resistors are not there. The emitters are directly grounded. Huh. I guess you could open up the ground with great difficulty and put a 0.01 ohm resistor in there on each side, but to confirm which side is drawing current, how would you do that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
Leave the call. I'll be back later to bring the CDL when I might stop.
We'll be here. You got it, Eric.
No, in this case, I'd probably cheat. I have an HP current probe that put it over a trace and it'll tell you what the DC current running through it is. You know, this thing is, the output, the collectors of both transistors would simply go to since it's broadband, it's a ferrite barrel, and actually it's a center tap transformer, if you want to think of it that way. What you can do, which is probably easiest, is to remove the, first of all, measure the voltages at the base and make sure they're balanced. The thing's got 10 ohm, half watt resistors between them. If one of those changes their value, that'll get you some problems. But you could lift the base of a transistor and see if it connects.
Yeah, but now you're getting kind of invasive. You got to be careful. I like in vivo measurements in the living animal. And you said something very nice before. If there was a tenth of an ohm resistor on emitter to ground and you measure the voltage drop with an RF voltmeter, that'd be beautiful. That resistor doesn't exist. However, he can make a poor man's non-directional coupler. He can take a piece of 085 or 0141 semi-rigid coax cable, make an extremely small loop of the center conductor with the Teflon on it, fold it back to the shield, where he makes a loop of a quarter of an inch diameter. That is a magnetic current sensing loop. That's a semi-rigid cable going through an adapter, into a piece of coax, into any kind of an RF sensing device, RF voltmeter, spectrum analyzer, or whatever. It's a very small current sensing device, short-circuited. And the Teflon is covering it, you don't short it in ground. While you hold it near the emitter of each transistor, which one is drawing current, which one is not. The current drawn by the transistor makes a strong magnetic field that's picked up by that loop. And makes the plane of the loop parallel to the actual lead of the emitter. It also uses it near the collector. Hold it near the collector. If one transistor is active and one is not, measure RF current, which is sensing the magnetic sniffer, which is not disturbing the circuit. I think that's going to give you a beautiful indication. What do you think of that, Larry?
There's enough separation in that vibration. Well, make a little pickup probe for the actually electrified. But no, you're right. If you, I don't remember whether you think
way of saying that I get rid of the other one at the same time all over the place. So if you can isolate it, you can know that you've got the right amount of drive, you've got the correct bias and space. If you don't have the output, you've got the appropriate voltage on the electric. Yeah, measuring the collector voltage switch might be your fault more often than different versions of it. When you pull off the switch, some kind of an output coil in range, some kind of an output coil with a semiconductor stuff, and set a tap, and the active transistor is putting voltage across the whole coil, typically almost the same voltage on both sides. However, if one side is active, one transistor is active to switch voltage, and one is not, you can set the key down for 3 seconds. Turn off the drive and put your finger on those two transistors. The one that's active is going to be hotter than the other one. It's going to be hotter. Just a finger temperature test will tell you are both transistors equally active. Can each of them change your eyes of his finger? Oh, I mean, you want better than I actually do, so I have it. Especially on some of the RMs that I work on, including these things, it's so good, so nicely distributed. When you point the little laser at the top of the transistor, you can definitely see the differences in temperature when things are right. So, yeah, no, I go with that. The thing is one method, but, you know, something a little more accurate is a little more reliable, let's say. But looking at this sensor, it's very, very simple. You know, to make a determination whether or not the amplifier itself is bad is pretty easy. You can figure that most alpha transistors in that kind of configuration, the gain's only going to be anywhere from 6 to, you know, 12 or 14 dB of gain maximum.
That thermal sensing voltmeter of yours, that's a thermometer of yours with an infrared dot. How expensive is that thing, Andy? I mean, Eric, that might be so inexpensive we all should have one. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, you can go to Harbor Freight and buy their cheap one for like $10. Or you can buy the Fluke, which I think is like $30 or $40. Yeah, they're very different price range, but they all essentially work the same.
Boy, that sounds like a nice thing to have. Let's see what Andy number one's going to say about all of the above. They're giving you a whole lot of homework here, Andy. N2HUH, Andy, H-U-R-I-W.
You know, don't forget about the relay, this is the output of this thing, because that can also make you not realize that you've got a bad connector, so to speak.
So when you use the push-to-talk switch, you should be able to confirm 0 ohms on certain contacts of that relay. Is that true, Eric?
Now, there's a relay there because of, right at the front, before it actually hits the filter, and it goes to, this actually goes to the receive input of the radio. And I've seen those relays fail and make lousy contact on the transmit side. And by the way, this is before the visual protection, so when it goes bad, you have no idea.
Okay, good information. Wait for the beep and HUH, you've got it.
Well, now you know, I don't feel so bad at 5 o'clock in the morning not doing all this. I do want to mention that I had all test equipment that was mentioned I have, except it's on the bench that was really crowded with other stuff from another hobby, so I couldn't get to it. And I had to go in there, which is a low voltage. I hate when that happens, but that's what I did. And thank you for that, Eric. And I'm glad I'm in good company with the radio and your extra ideas there. The relay, I didn't think about that. Well, honestly, that I did not think about at all. So, quite a lot there. I'll have to
narrow the bench and gets into all other hobbies and experiments and retail opportunities that it's hard to commit, you know, this whole setup like I do here. So, very good. And thank you for the info. And don't forget Andy, number two there. I don't like to call him number two, but when he lives up.
Now, one more thing for you.
Go ahead, Eric.
There's an actual line driver there. What is it? Yeah, it's a line driver. It's not a motor person. But those things run the relays for individual filters. If the filters are not being selected by that driver chip being bad, you'll run into the same sort of thing. Don't forget, for every band, there's the appropriate repeater.
Time out. Repeater. Time out. Cancel.
HOH, when you're able to hear DJ on the input, so you've got a complete set. What he said.
Oh, Dick, I switched over to the input and swapped on two preamps and I couldn't hear with all noise. I see. I need a fill.
All right, let me repeat that. Let me read it faster. Okay. If you actually look at the schematic, you'll find that there's a line driver. It's not a demultiplexer. It's not a four-line to X number of outputs. It's just a straight line driver. Each one of those line drivers, which is being fed by the computer, actually controls the relays for each appropriate low-pass filter. Don't forget, for every band that you operate, you've got to have these filters at the end of it. So there is a possibility that none of the filters are being switched in or all being switched in. I doubt that's the problem, but it could cause the same kinds of symptoms, so I'm saying just don't forget about that.
Yes, thank you for that, Eric. You know, I did miss that. I've had that problem with another radio, exactly as you said. I had that problem, exact problem with another rig that I was working on. It was I was scratching my head for quite a while, and I just didn't see that often enough. But thank you for that, for the heads up for that. That's a good point. Wow, I even feel better now at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, after all that, not going in any deeper without having my full bench available. So that's, I still don't go, honestly, but thank you for that, Eric.
You're welcome. I've gotten caught by that too once. That happened on radio a number of years ago. It's stuck in the back of my mind.
Let's see if we have anyone else with any good suggestions for an HUHUH on troubleshooting of this FT-847. Give me a call letter and name right now. Can you call either of you? Okay. We'll be looking forward to hearing from you later on tonight or next week, Jeff, any number one. That's such a nice rig, Jeff. It's worth making the investment to put it back on the air. So don't give up on this one. That's an awful nice looking rig. Great, you're next. 82CXK. Hope we can put you to sleep with all this jazz. Mr. CXK, TQIW in the TechNet.
Well, I think it's against FCC regulations to make a snoring sound. So, I was quite riveted. Okay, so let's go a little more theory for you, Dick. Oh, by the way, it's great. KD2CXK, should identify. I purchased my second Vitix 40 rig, which is Bravo India Tango X-Ray 40 rig, which is a single board. Not quite QRP, as it's able to drive up to 25 watts output, 40 meter sideband transceiver, which is built in India and is sold online. And the new version comes with a fully digital Arduino driven DDS for under $60 shipped. And I noticed that they use what appears to be a four pole crystal sideband filter, probably a lattice filter. I'll let it drop for a second. Oh, this is has four, I think they're 12 megahertz crystals, and they are very low profile, you know, surface mounted or to the board there. This is primarily, everything on this board is surface mounted with very few exceptions. Nice little package, and for the price, you can't really beat it. So my question here is about sideband filtering. What are the differences between mechanical filters and crystal filters, lattice filters, and other types of sideband filters? What are their theories behind their operation, and how does that help us achieve the filtering of a single sideband? Of course, you can include information about the VFO and so forth. So that's my question to you. I'm curious, Dick. K2RIW, KD2CXK, back to you.
Next, tonight at 8 o'clock, W2VL, repeater system.
I have a number of theories on this one. You guys are going to get a chance to correct me. If this is the best of all worlds, the LC networks that you use to build the filter should have a Q, the quality factor, of infinity. That means there's no series resistance on the coil, no series resistance on the leads of the capacitor of each individual LC resonator. But now let's get realistic. You build a good inductor and a good capacitor and put them together to get a Q of a couple of hundred is about the best you can hope for. Whereas a quartz crystal, under the most ideal conditions, when you put one in a vacuum environment, in a glass bulb, you can get a Q of almost 1 million out of a quartz crystal. So filtering characteristics of crystals has got a hell of a lot more capability. Any job? When it comes to a single sideband filter, one possible design criteria is you'd like to have a brick wall filter. You'd like to have a filter where the skirts are extremely steep. And so the carrier frequency is, let's say, 7 megacycles, and that at 100 hertz above that is where the passband of your crystal filter starts working, and from 100 hertz above that up to 5 kilohertz, we'll say, the filter has a beautiful passband with no insertion loss, and then drops off again with a almost a steep side. So the steepest wall on the filter is the one that's rejecting the carrier, because most of us use the filter technique for single sideband rejection. So you want a very steep slope, and crystal filters can give that to you. LC filters almost cannot do it. You end up with an LC filter having a sloppy skirt, but you throw in another notch filter on the carrier frequency, and you hope that'll give you most of what you want. So properly designed, crystal filters can really do some magic in a small package, because of that extremely high Q of each individual quartz resonator. And I know you guys got a lot more to say on this than I do. By the way, the mechanical resonator filter of Collins, let me drop it. I think it has some of the characteristics of a piezoelectric crystal. I think it is a piezoelectric circuit. So any piece of piezoelectric circuit properly used has this capability of very sharp filtering. You guys have probably got a lot more to say about the ideal filtering of LC versus lattice filters. Give me a call, that is a name, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, TJ.
You got it, Eric.
You know, there's more than one way to generate single sideband. I want to try and visualize it on the radio as opposed to looking at pictures. Let's go with the simplest method, which is a doubly balanced modulator, or a four-quadrant multiplier. And essentially what you're doing is you're making double sidebands where the energy is on both sides, and where there's no audio, there's no carrier. At peak audio, there's peak carrier. Based upon the frequency that you're generating, that's where the crystal or mechanical filter comes in. It slices off the sideband that you're not interested in. And the